Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The United Nations envoy to Libya says that despite Libya's internationally recognized government's rejection of a UN proposal for a power-sharing arrangement with rival Islamist-led authorities, the dialogue process would continue. Speaking in the Tunisian capital, Bernardino León says he came to insist that the process go on, that there is no chance for a small group of personalities to hijack the process. He adds that the majority of Libyans want a political solution and an end to the violence. Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita attended a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Paris Wednesday during a three-day state visit to France. He was joined by the French Junior Minister for Veterans beneath the Arc de Triomphe, where he laid a wreath on the tomb and then greeted French military members. Keita will spend 3 days in France, during which he will meet with the French president as well as with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The World Food Program's executive director says a lack of funds is hampering efforts to provide urgent support to Mauritanians and refugees fleeing instability in Mali. Itherin Cousin told the Associated Press Wednesday during a three-day trip to Mauritania that there is a funding shortage of $11 million. Security forces in Congo's Republic's capital fired warning shots and tear gas to disperse hundreds of protesters marching against a referendum they say is a ploy to extend the president's grip on power. President Denis Sassou Nguesso's critics accused him of seeking a referendum on Sunday to lift a limit for to extend his term. VOA News. The European Commission chief has called an emergency meeting of EU and Balkan leaders as a crowd of migrants fleeing the Middle East and Africa continue to flood into the Western Balkans. Jean-Claude Juncker says there is a need for greater cooperation among the nations dealing with the migrant crisis. He said he has invited the heads of state of 10 countries, including non-EU members, Macedonia and Serbia, to meet Sunday in Brussels to strategize. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has endorsed the country's nuclear deal with world powers, but he warns the agreement suffers from ambiguities and, he says, structural weaknesses. In a letter to the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, it was said that it was read on state television, rather, that Khamenei said such weaknesses could damage the country in the present and in the future. He urged Iranian officials to be vigilant in guarding against inconsistencies in the agreement. The European Commission ruled Wednesday that Starbucks and Fiat benefited from illegal tax deals with the Dutch and Luxembourg governments. This is the European Competition Commissioner, Marguerite Vestager.
The tax rulings have artificially reduced the tax burden of both companies, and this is illegal under EU state aid rules. These secessions send a clear message. National tax authorities cannot give any company, big or small, large or powerful, an unfair competitive advantage compared to others.
Meanwhile, Starbucks immediately said it would appeal, echoing the Dutch government and accusing the European Union executive of significant errors in its assessment. Meanwhile, Fiat denies receiving any aid from the Luxembourg state. China and Britain are to sign billions of dollars in deals as President Xi Jinping meets with Prime Minister David Cameron during the second day of the Chinese leader's state visit to Britain. The leaders are expected to formally announce a major deal that will see Chinese investors finance a third of the cost of the Hinkley Point C nuclear plant that is being built by French contractors in southwest England. The Vatican denied Wednesday an Italian media report that Pope Francis has a benign brain tumor. This is the chief Vatican spokesman, Father Federico Lombardi.
A proposito di una notizia che circolava
he says the circulation of an entirely unfounded news regarding the health of the Holy Father by an Italian newspaper is gravely irresponsible and unworthy of attention. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is calling on Israeli and Palestinian leaders to work to defuse a deadly wave of violence. You can read more on that at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
There are about 1 million people that are food insecure, and our concern now is that with the coming El Nino phenomenon, the forecast is that in those areas where normally there is a deficit of rain, the deficit will be larger or more intensified. And also the forecast is that in the areas where there is or normally there's more rain, there will be floods.
That's World Food Program's Madagascar country director Wilhelm van Millink speaking to VOA about the country's food shortage problem. Also, protesters return to Brazzaville's streets for the second day to try to block a referendum vote on Sunday. Cameroon welcomes the deployment of U.S. troops to help fight the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram, while there are indications a long-awaited African standby force may soon be operational. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, protesters return to Brazzaville's streets for the second day. They're trying to block a referendum vote on Sunday that could permit the president of the Republic of Congo to run for a third 7-year term in office. Crowds marched on a police station in a suburb of the capital today as army personnel arrived to support police officers as they retreated from the chanting crowds. 4 civilians were shot and killed yesterday when marchers began protesting against the possible re-election next year of President Denis Sassou Nguesso. He's been president for 30 of the last 36 years.
Kenya's coast offers beautiful beaches, good food, nice resorts, and a relaxed atmosphere. But Al-Shabaab attacked.
Well, tourism operators on Kenya's coast are welcoming a decision by the United States to lift travel restrictions for much of the area. The ban prevented U.S. government personnel from visiting the coast and discouraged many tourists from doing the same. VOA's Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
Coast offers beautiful beaches, good food, nice resorts, and a relaxed atmosphere. But Al-Shabaab attacks and crime threats have hurt tourism. Now the U.S. has lifted travel bans to much of the coast, from the town of Malindi down to areas near the border with Tanzania. Travel to Lamu Island, another popular destination on the Indian Ocean, remains restricted. This is Tiffany McGriff, press attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi.
The reason why we lifted the restrictions, while terror and crime threats remain throughout Kenya, the specific circumstances that led to the restriction in the coastal area south from Malindi have changed significantly as a result of positive action by the government of Kenya.
Britain lifted a travel warning to the same areas in June. And Susan Ongalo, acting CEO of the Kenya Tourism Federation, couldn't be happier.
Let me tell you, it is going to be a big boost to that region because looking at the previous month to June, tourism at the coast was really bad. And then in June, the UK revised their advisory. And now this is a big boost.
Ongalo says tourism drives the coast's economy.
I would say it is the biggest supporter of the coast economy because I wouldn't compare it to anything else.
The U.S. travel restrictions primarily affected U.S. government personnel, who were officially prohibited from visiting the region. But tourism operators say the restrictions deterred other tourists, some of whom found these kinds of bans invalidated their travel insurance. Mohammed Omar, general manager at Leopard Resort and Spa in Diani, south of Mombasa.
You know, the thing is, majorly UK and US are what people are looking at. Even if there are certain countries that do not have bans in terms of traveling, normally they would like to look at those two to see what's going on.
Tracy Peary, who manages the Flamboyant Hotel in Diani, says that because of security fears, as well as many foreign diplomatic staff and UN employees being banned from visiting the region, her business has dropped nearly 80% over the last 18 months.
We lost a lot of reservations. Yeah. We lost a lot of Nairobi reservations. They said they weren't allowed to travel to the coast any longer.
Even though the official ban is gone, a U.S. State Department travel warning advising Americans of the risks of visiting Kenya is still in effect. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Well, as the population of migrants entering Germany swells, the government says it may need to use military aircraft to deport economic migrants. Despite her willingness to take in political refugees, Chancellor Angela Merkel says those coming for economic reasons must leave. On the migrant route to Germany, the small nation of Slovenia has asked Austria to admit more migrants quickly as they trek through the small country of 2 million people. Some refugees suffered burns when tents at a camp in Brzeis at the Croatian border caught fire. Slovenian riot police offered aid to the victims and helped to put out the fire as fire trucks and ambulances arrived. Some of the estimated 1,000 migrants dropped off at another location on the Slovenian border today had to wade or swim the Sutla River in freezing temperatures. Many carry children on personal belongings on their backs and shoulders. On the Aegean Sea, Greek Coast Guard helicopters are searching for about 15 migrants whose small boat sank off the Turkish coast. The Aegean is a major crossing for more than 500,000 migrants who have fled to Europe this year. Another 140 migrants in two fishing boats landed on the shores of the island of Cyprus at a British airbase. And President Barack Obama announced last week the U.S. is sending 300 troops to Cameroon to help fight the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. The deployment, which began October 12th, is being welcomed by many in Cameroon and elsewhere. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
The U.S. mission will provide intelligence and surveillance to the existing multinational task force from Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Benin that is fighting Boko Haram extremists. While some say the deployment does not match the size of the threat, Cameroonian and senior associate at the National Democratic Institute, Christopher Famunyo, disagrees.
It's not just a numbers game, but I think it's the expertise that the 300 soldiers will bring, especially in the area of operational intelligence, being able to collect intelligence on the movements of these extremists, sharing that intelligence with Cameroonian soldiers, and making sure that it's put to use in a way that can really curb the spread of Boko Haram and undermine its attacks on Cameroonians.
Former Yaoundé University professor Serge Yondu, now living in America, says he's pleased at the U.S. decision.
Because none of those countries can fight Boko Haram alone. And even if they pool their resources together, those resources are not enough to fight such an asymmetric warfare.
A company director in Cameroon, Eric Chage, is a bit skeptical.
Une telle situation de crise appelle des énergies.
He says, I can understand that such a crisis situation needs energy and responses that are adapted to the situation. But we must not forget the states that come to help us have an interest in it. But Famunyo says in the face of Boko Haram attacks, something must be done.
You can't fold your hands and just rely on ideological reasons to say that Cameroon should not get direct assistance. I think the test of this kind of assistance is going to be seen over time.
Global fellow Steve McDonald of Washington's Wilson Center for International Scholars says he supports the move, but also knows that the U.S. Africa Command gets a mixed reaction on the continent.
Obviously, there are many, many Africans, both individuals and probably governments, like South Africans and others, who are suspicious and not supportive of AFRICOM and American direct military action in Africa. This has been apparent since the introduction of the African Command back in September 2007.
But he says there has been increasing understanding of the role AFRICOM can play in ensuring security in the region, especially with a common threat of extremist groups like Boko Haram. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Mariama. Well, following repeated delays, there are indications a long-awaited African standby force may soon be operational. Hopes were rekindled in mid-October after the AU and the government of Cameroon reached an agreement naming the nation as host of the force's logistics base. Interyiki Divine Jr. reports from Douala.
The logistics base has been planned for several years. Yet growing fears of terrorism and conflicts in Africa seem to increase pressure for its takeoff. Smile Shergi is the AU's Peace and Security Commissioner. In mid-October, he and Cameroon's Defense Minister Joseph Betty Asomo finalized an accord in Yaoundé, paving the way for making the base a reality.
Il fallait d'abord nous assurer d'un certain nombre de questions.
He says it was crucial to first clear several hurdles and put in place coherent and harmonized platforms on which the base will function. But the essential thing, he adds, is that the AU is ready to get the force functioning as soon as possible because of the prevailing determination and commitment from the government of Cameroon, the AU itself, as well as partners. The exact date for the start of operations at the Douala Logistics Base remain uncertain, but Shergi says its takeoff is critical in making the AU standby force operational. The force will include military officers, the police and civilians recruited from member countries and posted to five bases covering North, West, East, Southern and Central Africa. It will also contain guns, rockets and other ammunition, as well as fuel and heavy-duty military vehicles, including tanks. Shergi says spreading out the troops in regional bases will ensure rapid mobilization in times of trouble.
Et le plus important, c'est de la mettre en place rapidement.
He says the regional brigades will all depend on Douala for supplies, for the rapid deployment of the African force every time the need arises. The Cameroon government has allocated 20 hectares of land in Douala to accommodate the arsenal, whose last buildings are nearing completion at an Air Force base and a civil engineering military barracks. Government officials hail the base as a diplomatic victory and applaud the creation of jobs for locals. But skeptics fear the new Douala warehouse could place the local population at risk of attacks by terror groups like Boko Haram and pirates along the Gulf of Guinea. But Shergi, who has met with officials at the Cameroon presidency, says measures are in place to reduce the threat.
Et nous avons à la fois la détermination.
He says the meetings enabled him to convey the AU's message of consideration and acknowledgement for the frontline role Cameroon has been playing for peace and security on the continent and particularly in the Central African sub-region, especially with its deployment of peacekeepers to the war-ravaged Central African Republic as well as its contributions to the fight against Boko Haram. He says possibilities of such attacks are negligible. On October 19, the standby force began its first ever military simulation exercises in South Africa. Some 5,000 soldiers and police officers from contributing countries are taking part in the tryouts, which will run until early November. The African Union says the exercises are intended to get the force ready by January next year. Contributing countries still must agree on personnel quotas as well as funding due contribution by member countries and donors. The decision to install the logistics base in Cameroon's largest port city and economic hub was announced back in January 2011. This after Douala beat Algiers in a hotly contested two-year bid. The continent's defense ministers unanimously agreed that the logistics base belonged in Central Africa and on the shores of the Atlantic. Douala was determined to be the best location given its road, rail, and air links to the rest of the continent.
That was Interyiki Divine Jr. reporting from Douala, Cameroon. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 20 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Protesters return to Brazzaville's streets for the second day to try to block a referendum vote on Sunday. Cameroon welcomes the deployment of U.S. troops to help fight the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram, while there are indications a long-awaited African standby force may soon be operational. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Riot police have fired stun grenades at students in front of South Africa's parliament and a Port Elizabeth campus as protest over a proposed hike in university tuition fees spreads to more than 10 campuses. In Cape Town, some of the students broke into the parliament to disrupt the finance minister's reading of an interim budget. Some legislators who support the student protest scuffled with security and were removed from the chamber. About 20 University of Cape Town students were arrested yesterday. They had been released but are to appear in court next week on charges of defying a court order. The university was closed today. Aid officials say severe food shortages are sweeping southern Africa, affecting 27 million people in the region. One afflicted country stands apart, Madagascar. The Indian Ocean island is reporting severe food insecurity, mostly due to bad weather that has destroyed or impaired harvests. But this island nation off Africa's east coast is known for being different. World Food Program's Madagascar country director Wilhelm von Millink told VOA News during a recent sit-down in Johannesburg that this uniqueness should drive the response to Madagascar's food shortages.
There are about 1 million people that are food insecure, and out of those 1 million people, there are 400,000 people that are severely food insecure. This is the consequence of a couple of years of a lack of rains, especially in the southern region of Madagascar. And our concern now is that with the coming El Nino phenomenon, the forecast is that in those areas where normally there is a deficit of rain, the deficit will be larger or more intensified. And also the forecast is that in the areas where there is or normally there's more rain, there will be floods.
Now, as we know, Madagascar has had a rough ride politically in the last decade. Mm. What role does that instability have on this situation?
We've seen, if you take a look also at what happened during the every 7 or 10 years political crisis that have occurred, the economic situation has deteriorated even much more in those periods. So it's in the last one, which was a very long transition period that went from 2009 up to the end 2013, December 2013, when the elections took place, the country was actually in almost with no means to face all type of problems.
As you know, Madagascar is a unique ecosystem and it's a unique country. How does its uniqueness affect the solution we might need to get it out of this situation?
Indeed, Madagascar, if you could define it in one word, would be the word different. It's a continent that has been separated from the mainland for tens of millions of years and has developed an incredible fauna and flora not found anywhere else. There's many, many areas in which we would have to work. I think governance is a priority area, but of course also working with the farmers that they have other alternatives to use the charcoal, for example, using fuel stoves that are economic, or not doing slash and burn all over the place. Or helping people also to get access to good nutrition and not having to eat other types of animals, you know, even lemurs, for example. Those types of interventions, I would say, at different levels. Governance, really, at the national level. Deforestation at the national level. And then food insecure interventions in areas where the people are most affected.
And finally, can you tell us about the further long-term consequences of this situation? For example, how could this affect Madagascar's progress on reaching the UN's Millennium Development Goals, which, as you know, come due this year?
No, so Madagascar has not been able to reach any of the Millennium Development Goals except the one on HIV/AIDS, but that was also because it started at a very, very low level compared to Southern Africa. So it's clear that all these political problems during the past years and bad governance, and coupled with also all other types of disaster, every year a couple of cyclones, every year droughts, and a very low capacity to build resilience with populations has been a main factor.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you for your interest also in the situation in Madagascar. Madagascar is a very isolated country that needs a lot of attention, requires much more help in order to face the problems it's currently facing.
That was VOA's Anita Powell speaking with World Food Program Madagascar Country Director Wilhelm van Millink. Well, Malawi's government has approved growing industrial hemp for export on a trial basis. The decision followed years of heated debate, and the proposal continues to meet resistance from anti-drug activists and religious leaders. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
Hemp resurfaced on the agenda in May when Parliament member Boniface Kazamira asked lawmakers to reconsider the plant's economic potential. Industrial hemp can be used to make paper, fabric, soap, medicine, and even food products. Kazamira says it is different than marijuana, known locally as chamba.
And you know, when we talk of chamba in Malawi, people think of madness, crime. But now, when time has gone by, people have now understood that this is purely a commercial crop.
But the move was anti-drug campaigners worried. Nelson Zakeu is director for the local NGO Drug Fight Malawi.
That will just give an easy access to marijuana. The country will have so many problems. Some of the problems are gun shootings, suicides, as it is in some states in the U.S., like California.
However, industrial hemp has a different composition from marijuana, says Tony Baden, the director of a South African company, Herbarium.
We have to bring in the certified low-drug varieties, and they come from Europe, so we have to see if they're going to grow here in Malawi. If they don't grow, then we have to look around Malawi to see maybe there's also industrial hemp in Malawi, or we can see how we can make new varieties that grow well for Malawi's climate.
Deputy Chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Agriculture, Joseph Chidanti Malunga, told local radio that hemp will boost the economy.
I understand the money that it fetches is more than what tobacco would fetch on a given unit area. So we think that if we go this direction, we might even surpass what we get from tobacco.
Religious leaders disagree. Dina Rajabulika is the spokesperson for the Muslims Association of Malawi.
Whether it is going to boost the economy or not, it is not acceptable. There is no any permission Islam gives to any drug or something that will disturb the intelligence of a human being. So our recommendation is it should not be done.
The government has authorized trial cultivation of industrial hemp at Chitedze Agricultural Research Station starting next year in the capital, Lilongwe. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah, now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to
to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Protesters returned to Brazzaville streets for the second day to try to block a referendum vote on Sunday. Cameroon welcomes the deployment of U.S. troops to help fight the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram, while there are indications a long-awaited African standby force may soon be operational. Coming up, we'll have music from Yvonne Shaka Shaka and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And hello, Sunny, and welcome back.
Thanks, Kim. It's good to be back. And I had a very nice trip last week to Lagos, Nigeria. Want to know what I did there, Kim?
Yes, please tell us.
Well, I visited our VOA partner stations, Channels Television and Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. The stations broadcast all across Africa's most populous country, about 170 million people. And let me give official Sunny Side of Sports shout-outs for Austin Okon-Akpan at Channels and Dr. Larry Zamajay at Brilla. They were both very welcoming, and they allowed me to appear on some of their sporty programs. Thanks, Austin and Dr. Larry. One of the athletes I met during my trip to Lagos was Ndidi Madu, a power forward for Nigeria's national women's basketball team, nicknamed the Tigress. Ndidi was born in the southern U.S. state of Tennessee, and she played college basketball at the University of Florida. Ndidi and the Tigress finished third at the recent Afrobasket for women in Cameroon. Senegal won a record-extending 11th African title in Yaoundé, beating host Cameroon 81-66 in the final. In the bronze medal match, Ndidi Madu in Nigeria beat Angola 65-55 to keep alive their hopes of qualifying for next year's Olympic women's basketball tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Senegal booked a ticket to Rio by winning the trophy, while Cameroon and Nigeria advanced to a 2016 Olympic qualifying tournament. Ndidi and I appeared on the Sports Tonight Show on Channels Television, and she talked about her Olympic dreams.
You know, we just finished the Afrobasket tournament in Cameroon, so right now we're just getting ready to head to the qualifying playoff tournament next June. We don't know where it will take place yet, but that's what we get. That's what our focus is right now. It's just to get our mindset to the playoff tournament and to finish top five. So the game versus Cameroon was a hard-fought game. You know, we went down to the very, very last second, and you know, it wasn't God's will for us to win that game because it was a hard-fought game, and it should have been our game. We was the best team in Cameroon. We knew it. Everybody knew it who watched us play from all over. So, you know, it just wasn't God's will for us to win. So we're just going to just focus. We're going to continue to work hard and get ready to go to the playoffs.
Now, Ndidi, I understand the USA might have had a little bit of a role in developing your basketball skills.
They did. You know, I went to the University of Florida. I'm a Gator. Go Gators. you know, I grew up in the U.S., and so I've been playing basketball in the U.S. My whole life until 2013. With 2012, actually, when I started my collegiate, my professional career in Spain, and then I actually had a chance to play with the national team for the first time in 2013. But you know, up until 2012, USA basketball, you know, playing in the U.S. is all I really knew.
How did Nigeria approach you to be on the women's
team?
Well,
it was actually Helen, the captain of the Tigress, and I got in contact with her, and I just expressed to her that I want to play for Nigeria. You know, what do I need to do? What's the steps? I'm ready to do it. And so she just really was just awesome, and she really helped me in every step of the way. And so she sent my film in to the federation and everything, and then I got my official invitation to training camp. And from there, it just, you know, I've been part of the team. So I'm just very grateful for the opportunity. Mm.
That's Ndidi Madu, a power forward for Nigeria's national women's basketball team. And Ndidi was talking with me on the Sports Tonight show on Channels Television in Lagos, Nigeria.
Voice of America!
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
In African youth football, the four-time champion Golden Eaglets of Nigeria have spread their young wings and soared into the knockout stage at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Umo reports the Nigerian boys advanced with a resounding victory over the host country.
Defending champions and Nigeria Golden Eaglets went on the rampage, beating hosts Chile 5-1 in their Group A tie in the coastal city of Viña del Mar on Tuesday. Having won their opening match against the United States of America, the Golden Eaglets have qualified for the knockout phase with a game in hand. In Group B action, South Korea pipped Guinea 1-0 in La Serena. Today, Wednesday, Mali engaged Ecuador in a Group D encounter in Talca. In Switzerland, reigning Africa Footballer of the Year Yahya Touré of the Ivory Coast is among the nominees shortlisted for the 2015 FIFA Ballon d'Or Award, the World Football Governing Body FIFA disclosed in Zurich on Tuesday. Touré is the only African among the 23 nominees. Staying in Zurich, the elections of a new FIFA president will go ahead as scheduled on the 26th of February next year, the FIFA Executive Committee confirmed on Tuesday. All candidates who seek to contest the FIFA presidential elections have until next Monday, the 26th of October, to submit all relevant documents to FIFA. Still in Zurich, FIFA's Independent Ethics Committee, at its discretion, is now allowed to publish more information about their ongoing proceedings, FIFA disclosed on Tuesday. The FIFA Executive Committee sought the crucial amendment of Article 36 of the FIFA Code of Ethics to permit the Ethics Committee to shed more light on their work in the spirit of transparency. FIFA is at the center of an unprecedented high-profile investigation affecting several prominent members of the organization, including FIFA President Sepp Blatter. Turning to athletics, the city of Tampere in Finland is the only candidate bidding to stage the 2018 World Junior Athletics Championship, the World Athletics Governing Body IAAF disclosed in Monaco on Tuesday. The IAAF revealed that the Danish capital Copenhagen has applied to host the 2018 World Half Marathon Championship, an event they first staged last year. The cities of Sopot in Poland and Valencia in Spain are also bidding to stage the event. The IAAF will name the successful bids in Monaco next month. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Because
this is Africa. Time for Africa.
Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us again on the Sunny Side of Sports for a look at recent African goal-scoring highlights in Europe And David kicks off with an Ivorian striker.
Wilfred Bonny was on good form for Manchester City in the English Premier League. He bagged the brace, the second and the fifth goals in a 5-1 thrashing of Bournemouth. And Bonny recently said that he's just recovered from a bout of malaria. And that's a good boost for a player who was a big money transfer from Swansea City, but has been battling to get into the starting lineup at Manchester City. Another African player who was on target in the English Premier League was Mbokani from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He scored for Norwich City away to Newcastle, but unfortunately the goal was not of a great deal of help because Newcastle, who've been really struggling in the Premier League this season, they cruised to a 6-2 victory. If we move across to Italy, there was a goal from Mohamed Salah, the Egyptian, for Roma. Roma winning 3-1 against Empoli. And that was the fourth goal of the season for a player who is on loan from the English club Chelsea. In France, for Angers, the Senegalese midfielder Ndoye scored in a 2-1 victory at Toulouse. And also in France, Mukanjo, the Cameroonian who plays for Lorient, he scored in a 1-1 draw at Marseille. And a name that is all too familiar to listeners to The Voice of America, Solomon Kalou, the veteran Ivory Coast striker. He scored for Hertha Berlin, but unfortunately it was not enough to prevent Schalke from a 2-1 victory.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. The Springboks of South Africa will face the All Blacks of New Zealand Saturday in a semi-final match at the Rugby World Cup in England. Argentina goes against Australia Sunday in the second semi-final. Both games will be played at Twickenham Stadium in London. South Africa's head coach, Heineke Meyer, says the Springboks will have to produce their best ever performance to beat the All Blacks.
I must say that I really mean this. It's not just talk. This is probably the best team that I believe that's ever played the game. If you just look at their record the last 4 years after the World Cup, usually after the World Cup there's a decline in performance. Steve has been there for 8 years as assistant and most of the coaching staff has gone on. So they just got better after the previous World Cup, which hasn't happened in World Rugby. So, you know, this is a different team, but Therese faced them. He's faced the best teams in the world. He's faced the British and Irish Lions. So he knows what it takes. And we as a team know that this must be our best performance probably ever if we want to beat them, because they are the best team I think that's ever played the game.
This game between South Africa and New Zealand is a matchup of two-time World Rugby champions. South Africa lifted the trophy in 1995 and 2007, while New Zealand were the rugby kings in 1987 and 2011. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see some photos of my recent trip to Lagos, Nigeria. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and it's good to have you back. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, a South Sudanese scholar studies the root causes of ethnic tensions in South Sudan. And Amnesty International accuses Hungary of breaking multiple human rights laws in its handling of refugees. First, here's Yvonne Shaka Shaka with I Am In Love With The DJ.
City.
nowhere to go. I have no one to talk to except the voice on the radio.
This is your Rainbow Station, KMOD, FM 95, out of Wichita, Kansas, where the man says it's gonna be coming down all night. I hope you're warm and tight, honey. If you're feeling alone, baby, just get on the phone and talk to me. Just get on the phone, honey.
It makes me feel so special and so close to me. He cheers me up. He makes me smile. He makes my life worthwhile.
That's South Africa's Yvonne Chaka Chaka. Well, Catholic University of Eastern Africa graduate Sylvia Williams is back in South Sudan's Upper Nile State after spending 4 months studying at the United States Institute of Peace here in Washington, D.C. Williams studied the root causes of ethnic tensions in South Sudan. He believes a deeper understanding of this issue could speed the healing and reconciliation process in his country. Ayan Bior has the story from Washington.
What leads a person to commit violent acts against another? Where did the issue of ethnic violence originate from? How can South Sudan move toward tribal harmony? These are just some of the questions Sylvia Williams and a team of researchers are looking into at the United States Institute of Peace, Although the issues are complicated, William says the reason for the prolonged fighting among some South Sudanese ethnic communities can be summarized in one sentence.
They want to show that they also exist and they need to be recognized in the politics of South Sudan.
Emily Fornoff, a program assistant at USIP who worked with William, says his research was beneficial in furthering her understanding of the ethnic violence in South Sudan.
I think one of his most surprising findings was that a lot of it is due to the drawing of the county boundaries. It caused a lot of problems because they kept redrawing them without consulting with the population.
William says long-lasting tensions in his home country stem from a lack of practical dialogue between South Sudan's communities. He says that other factors that lead to violence are cattle raids, lack of services outside the capital, and a lack of transparency and accountability from government officials.
Then also I found that there is an issue of politics of identity, where a group of, tribes try to, form a kind of movement to fight other tribes, thinking that they have been marginalized, for example, and so they have to fight in order to get their rights.
William says President Kiir's recent move to create a total of 28 states did not just create additional states, it separated people based on ethnic identity. Splitting communities, according to William, could make matters worse and prolong the path to reconciliation. William says the government must consider all impacts of creating new states before redrawing the country's map.
It's very important that it has to be really realized by the government of South Sudan to make sure that there is studies, there is, survey before they decide to create county, for example, or a state in this case.
William also suggested an aggressive nationwide economic development plan be implemented. He says economic and structural development will raise the standard of living in South Sudan and convince citizens that they can also prosper in their own country.
The most important is nationalism. We have to create, we have to develop sense of nationalism within South Sudan. And that is the only way that we can overcome, tribal lines or tribal interests within our community.
For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Amnesty International has accused Hungary of breaking multiple international and European human rights laws in its handling of the refugee crisis. As Henry Ridgewell reports, thousands of migrants and refugees continue to travel through the Balkans to Hungary every day.
With more than 1,200 refugees and migrants packed on board, another train arrives at Croatia's border with Hungary to offload its desperate human cargo. In the past month, more than 50 trains like this have ferried migrants across Croatia. A new fence is being built on the Hungarian side of the frontier. Until that is finished, these migrants are being allowed through and onward to Austria and beyond. Hosting his Croatian counterpart in Budapest Wednesday, Hungary's president, Janos Adair, defended his country's handling of the crisis. He says the two countries agreed this migrant crisis is a humanitarian and criminal issue and a national security question. Croatian President Kolinda Grabar-Kitarovic backed Hungary's call for stronger border controls across Europe. Barbora Chernasakova of Amnesty International says Budapest has broken international human rights laws and European Union legislation.
Hungary, by sealing off its border with Serbia and by introducing accelerated asylum procedures at the border, which results to summary rejections of all the applicants and their return to Serbia, to return to a country where there is an adequate reception facilities. Then we are concerned about the fact that Hungary is criminalizing entry through the border fence.
Amnesty says Hungarian police also used excessive force against migrants the day after it closed the border with Serbia last month, firing tear gas and water cannon at the crowds. Human rights groups say the refugee crisis exposes the worst of Europe's divisions on immigration. Addressing the European Parliament Wednesday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel appealed for unity. EU ministers agreed Thursday to step up deportations of failed asylum seekers. They hope it will stem the flow of thousands of economic migrants arriving alongside the refugees fleeing war and persecution. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Working, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is donating $15.7 million worth of food commodities to Malawi to assist a portion of the 2.8 million people in need of humanitarian food assistance. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, made the announcement in late September. This assistance is in response to the government of Malawi's September 21st appeal for donor support, following the Vulnerability Assessment Committee findings in July 2015. As a result of the unfavorable 2014-2015 farming season, 2.8 million Malawians in 24 districts will require food assistance from October 2015 to March 2016. The late onset of rains, severe flooding, mid-season dry spells, and early ending of rains contributed to the approximately 30% reduction in Malawi's maize crop. The UN Food Program will receive and distribute the United States food donation of 6,250 metric tons of beans and 2,810 metric tons of vitamin A and D fortified vegetable oil as part of a larger food basket designed to meet the nutritional requirements of those in need. The food donation will arrive in Malawi beginning in October 2015. Since 2012, the United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has provided over $55 million worth of food assistance to address food insecurity stemming from recurrent adverse weather in Malawi. In August 2014, the United States provided $7 million through the World Food Program to support the MVAC response to the seasonal food insecurity that affected 640,000 people in 19 districts across Malawi. Earlier this year, the United States provided further assistance, totaling $9.3 million, to Malawi when the country experienced widespread, devastating floods. Beyond our humanitarian assistance, the United States provides approximately $25 million per year under President Obama's Feed the Future and climate change initiatives that are building resilience among vulnerable households in central and southern Malawi. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, stressed that it is important to tackle agricultural shortfalls holistically. The United States, she said, is committed to Malawi's welfare and development, and we are proud to partner with the people of Malawi in this time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.